Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll talk to the two remaining charter members from what became a phenomenon, the Beardstown Ladies Investment Club. Based in West Central Illinois, the ladies' take on investing gained fame and critics, but the group is still going strong. With the arrival of cicadas, an opportunity to make music with the insects, and we'll learn more about them from a cicada superfan. Five University of Chicago students who joined pro-Palestinian demonstrations on the campus are in limbo as the school is withholding their degrees. And later this hour, a man tells his story of being gay, homeless, and his mother's mental illness. That and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, the Beardstown Ladies Investment Club is an organization which gained worldwide fame after publishing a book on investing in the 1990s. The group of women was, and still is, based in the small Illinois town in Cass County. The two remaining charter members, Cornell Korsmeyer and Ann Brewer, recently sat down for an interview with Vanessa Ferguson to discuss how the club was formed, the fame and controversy, along with advice for those wanting to learn investing.
How long have you lived in Central Illinois? And tell us a little bit about your time living here. And we'll start with you.
Well, I've lived in Cass County, Beardstown, all my entire life, and graduated from Beardstown High School. And I graduated at 17, started working for the Beardstown School District, and continued for nearly 50 years.
Wow.
And I became a member of the Beardstown Business and Professional Club because that was a club for ladies, working ladies. So a lot of us were also interested in investing, and that's why we got our name, was Beardstown Business Women Professional Investment Club. And so from there, wanted to learn, and we were in a club 1980 to 82, and then the Beardstown Ladies, which is still the same name, but we're known as the Beardstown Ladies now.
Yeah. And Carno, what about you? Have you always lived in Central Illinois?
I've lived in Beardstown or surrounding area for 96 years. Like Anne, I was a member of the Beardstown Professional and Women's Club. And then that national organization recognized that women often become widows and have no idea how to manage their money. And so they encouraged people to start investment clubs. And one was started at the BPW Club. And it had over 30 members, which proved pretty unwieldy because we had difficulty coming to a decision. So eventually it disbanded, and then several of us who wanted to continue met, and we met at the First National Bank in their boardroom. There were 16 of us, and there were 16 chairs around the table, so we limited the membership to 16.
Practical. I love that.
And then we could function.
Yeah. Well, talk to me a bit about those early days of the Beardstown Ladies Investment Club. One of the things that I found interesting was I read an article about you all, and one of the members said that she had difficulty even getting a broker to talk to her. Like, the broker insisted that, like, put your husband on the phone. And I wondered if you remember that kind of backlash or pushback from people saying women don't need to be investing.
Shirley Gross was a member of our club, and she wanted to invest, but no broker would take her because she was a woman. And then finally she found one, Homer Reagan here in Springfield. And he said, I don't care if you're a woman, I just care if you have money to invest.
As it should be.
Also, myself, oftentimes when brokers would call, they'd always ask to talk to my husband.
And what did you think about that?
Well, at the time, it was just the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually we came to know, no, we need to know something about this.
So then you decide you're going to be in this investment club. How difficult was that to get the ball rolling? I mean, I'm an MBA student, and I can't imagine doing what you all do just from scratch like that.
Well, we joined NAIC and followed their guidelines for the most part.
I think as a group, from that first club, 2 years, and we made money, and we knew we wanted to continue to have a club. I think that learning together, when you're an individual starting out knowing nothing, is easier. And having Shirley, who was an investor privately, personally, and she had a large home, and we could meet at her house for periodically for potlucks. She had, what do I say, the tools, the knowledge, which when we met there as a stock selection guide, as a committee, or as a group, we were on our own. She didn't say, oh, you should do this and that and the other. And I think we have to give a lot to Shirley.
Well, bless Shirley. Thank you to Shirley for helping out there. But as I'm thinking about investing, I mean, I talked to quite a few people who know they need to do it, but it is so daunting. What are some tips maybe you could give, or what variables do you look at, your club looks at, when you're deciding which stocks to invest in? I mean, are there certain things that you look at?
I would like to say early on, Homer Regan, our broker, said, you know, think after we got started with him, he said, think of things that you use, whether the markets are high or low. What companies do you know? What companies do of things of products that do you use, you're familiar with? That isn't true today, but there was a time back in the 80s and the 90s that we did a lot of that. And then I think we invested the $25 per month, and still do. If you get in the habit of doing that, and then after your company, you invest, you have a stock selection committee, and they have the guide to follow. And I think that takes a lot of the fear away of companies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So can you ladies kind of tell me, I mean, you've had a few decades here of investing. What was one of your best investments, and then what was one of your worst investments? Were you willing to tell me a couple that come to mind?
Well, a couple of our best at present time has been Apple and Amazon.
Yeah, that's really funny because I remember when Amazon started and I was like, I don't know, guys, they're just selling books. I really like going to the bookstore. I don't know that they're going to be successful. Don't ever listen to me for advice is essentially what I'm getting at. Carnell, what about you? You made a look like you maybe remembered one or two that came to mind.
I think there's a rule, isn't there? How many, if you invest in so many, out of three, one will do really well, one will do about what you expect, and the other one will tank.
All right. Well, we're being tight-lipped on the names, but that's okay. I appreciate the insight because I want to ask you, too, investing, it's not for the lighthearted, I don't think. Like, it can make you panic. And you all have lived through the dot-com bust and the housing market crash. So I wanted to ask you, what were those experiences like as investors as you were seeing those events unfold and how they influenced the market at those times? Can you recall what that was like?
I don't think you go with the flow. You establish a pattern of investing and stick with it. And things will go up and things will go down, but you stay with it.
It sounds like it's good to stay calm. Would you say that's true?
Well, you try.
And we used to say, sell high and buy low.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's very hard at different periods of time to find a stock that you want to put your money in when the markets are high as well as low. But I think this being steady and patience is very important.
Yeah. So you have some really good advice, your organization does, and then you ended up writing a book that really led you to national, I'll even say worldwide popularity. So I want to ask you about that worldwide success. So first, can you tell us about some of the TV shows that your members appeared on?
We were on Phil Donahue early on, and then NBC came to Beardstown, actually, and interviewed us in the park.
Wow. And I understand you were also in People magazine?
A long time ago.
Yes, mm-hmm. I think we were. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So not a lot of people from Central Illinois have that kind of success or that kind of fame. What was that like for you all to be featured in these national media?
Life goes on.
I'd like to say that we're still the same ladies that we were, same personalities. And as I said earlier, we didn't sell our house and buy a big house. We didn't switch husbands. And I think in our day and age, we were just the plain people we've always been.
So you also all traveled to many different countries. Can you tell us about some of the countries that your members visited? Because I really want our audience to understand that you were kind of a phenomenon. In the 90s, you received a lot of attention. So where did your members travel?
They were in Germany, England, Brazil, all over the United States at various times, Hawaii, Alaska.
Wow, a lot of different places. Now, I do have to bring this up because I was doing some research and I just, to be fair and accurate. So there was a little bit of backlash from the book. Your organization made an accounting error when it was trying to calculate the return on investments. And I think the Wall Street Journal summarized the situation really well. They said it was just a goof. And they pointed out actually that although that return on investment wasn't as high as you had thought it was, they pointed out that an outside auditor found that the club's average annual return from 1983 to 1997 was 15.3%, which outpaced the Dow at that time. So even though there was maybe a wrong calculation on one period of time, it sounds like you really did learn how to do well with the stock market. And I want to take a positive look at this here because you gave thousands of people encouragement that they could invest. And your group inspired other investment groups throughout the U.S. So how do you feel about leaving that legacy? Because again, I talk to so many people and they are so scared of doing this. But you inspired thousands of people to do this. I mean, how do you feel about that?
I think because they saw us as we were from the rural area of Beardstown. We were everyday people. And if we could do it, they felt they wanted to start a club when we encouraged them to start a club. Could be family club, could be an office, business, whatever, community. And I think having a group of people wanting to learn, and like we talked, they talked about the three E's, and that's the main thing, I think. And I think we'd have to say we're very pleased, very humbled, but
yeah,
very
yeah.
pleased.
Carnell, what about you? How do you feel about that legacy? You're very much a part of it.
Well, our emphasis has always been on education, and anybody can stand to increase their education. We used to say when we spoke to people, if we can do this, you can too.
Now, we do want to get an update on what the club is doing. So are you the last two charter members of the organization?
Yes, we are.
Okay. And is it still just 16 members that you have in the club?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what is the club doing now? I mean, you've seen a little more than 40 years go by. What's the current status? How's it going?
I think it's very nice to know we have a lot of newer members, and we are now in our, third generation? Yeah. Recently, we just took in Carol's daughter. I think passed on in families. And I'd like to say they follow the agenda. So we try to have education after our committee reports and their stock selection committee. And then if they want to visit, they can visit afterwards. But we like the short meetings. I think that's important. And now with the technology, if you're wanting to start, you could Zoom, have your families. And we didn't have that back in the 80s.
Yeah, absolutely.
But now it's possible.
Yeah. Carnell, what about you? How do you feel about the way things are or the status of the club today, 40 years later?
Well, like Anne, it's really encouraging to have younger members starting. We encourage everybody to try, even grandchildren, if that's possible. Oftentimes, our members will give stock as gifts to grandchildren or children.
Yeah. So I was teasing you earlier. I said, so are you a bunch of secret millionaires? And you told me you weren't. But one of you said something that I thought was really important, that it only takes $25 a month to practice investing. So you may not be millionaires, but how well did you do with the investing in this past 40 years?
Well, at one time, our portfolio was worth $1 million, and that's at $25 a month.
So, yeah.
So we've done quite well, and primarily we've learned a lot, and that's always been the emphasis. Education was always the main emphasis.
Yeah. Do you ever spend any of that money, or do you just keep reinvesting it?
Well, we've taken out individual times, and I think they had projects they wanted to do or a trip they wanted to go, so they're quite what they put in their account. But I think most of us have just like, okay, we would have spent our $25 on a lunch, so it's gone.
Yeah.
By putting the $25 monthly, that we've seen the assets grow. And I think it's also very important, as I said before, to pay yourself first and then pay the bills. My parents always said, no matter what you make, it's what you save. So if you don't feel like you want to make an investment, don't have enough money to make an investment, start saving until you get a couple hundred dollars or $1,000 and then invest in something you're interested in, or you feel like it's something that will be in good market and bad market.
If you reinvest your dividends and profits, that's like money found. So if you don't spend it, you reinvest it, we've really gained.
Yeah. I want to add to that, too, because there was something that I did wrong early on, which was I saved and I saved and I saved, and then I paid off all my debt, but I never invested. And so I've learned a valuable lesson, which is sometimes it's better just to invest because what you're earning is a lot more than what you're paying in interest. And I just wanted to see if you had any other lessons like that, that you've noticed throughout the years, because I just learned not that long ago that you'll never save enough, save as fast as you'd like to beat inflation. So really you need to be investing. So that's just surprised me. And it was so against the grain of what my family had practiced for decades. But I really appreciate what you all do with money, with investing it. Are there any other tips like that or thoughts that you might have on that?
I think one of the things is to take advantage of the 401ks. And sometimes now, I don't know anything about companies now. It's a whole different world. But if you get a chance to take advantage of the, sometimes they will match, companies will match what you're putting in. I would say that would be the best investment you could ever make. And another thing, I think, perhaps because of my age, I don't need the things that I thought I needed 40 years ago. Do I need this or do I just want this? Say dress, jewelry. I think put that money in for savings for investment.
You don't have to have a lot of money to start investing. Just start small and it grows.
Cornell Korsmeyer and Ann Brewer, the two remaining charter members of the Beardstown Ladies Investment Club, they spoke with Vanessa Ferguson. Illinois lawmakers in their just-completed spring session hit the brakes on the state's burgeoning carbon capture and storage industry. We have more from Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco.
Polluting industries want to pipe planet-warming carbon dioxide into the ground. It's part of a controversial climate solution called carbon capture. Pam Richard is an advocate with the Coalition to Stop CO2 Pipelines. She calls the technology unsafe.
So we got a moratorium on CO2 pipelines.
The temporary ban is a first in the Midwest and expires in 2 years. The Biden administration has poured billions of dollars into getting carbon capture off the ground. Governor J.B. Pritzker has yet to sign the sweeping regulations into law, but has signaled his intention to do so. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco, WBEZ News.
The graduation season may be over, but there's still controversy at the University of Chicago. We have more on that coming up. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. 5 University of Chicago students are in limbo because they took part in pro-Palestinian demonstrations. College officials have put their degrees on hold. Some faculty say the decision raises questions about the university's commitment to free speech. Lisa Korean-Phillip reports.
As a high schooler, Reina Acha saw college as a way to escape and make a better life for herself. Now she says she's stuck. On June 1st, she was supposed to graduate from the University of Chicago, but officials decided to withhold her degree over her participation in the Gaza Solidarity Encampment on campus last month, at least for now.
When I first got the email, I was like, oh my God, so they're going to take this away and then make me spend months and months of my life waiting to get my degree to make us an example for what they're willing to do to people who are organizing and organizing for Palestine specifically.
University officials say complaints have been filed against the encampment and that Acha may be involved. She hasn't been told who made the complaints, only that she's accused of disrupting university operations. She does know that without a degree, her life is on hold.
I'm kind of in this like weird space of like unemployment where I don't have parents who are going to just be able to like pay my rent or anything like that, but I know that I have to find a job within this month.
Debate at UChicago over the decision to keep Acha and 4 other students from graduating is largely breaking down along the same lines as the debate over the encampment. Geophysics professor Dorian Abbott, for one, felt the encampment got in the way of teaching and research.
Protest is okay as long as it doesn't disrupt basic university functions. I had students who couldn't make it to their class because of this encampment. And there were classes that couldn't go on due to chanting and loudspeaker.
So Abbott believes the decision to withhold the students' degrees is fair. He notes it's temporary until there's a resolution to the disciplinary process.
I think that's necessary in a situation like this.
This is a system that's very easily weaponized.
Mathematics professor Dennis Hirschfeld says the encampment was less disruptive than some official university events. He says withholding degrees is far too punitive. University officials refused to answer questions about the decision. Hirschfeld says it's the result of a flawed disciplinary process.
It's a massive conflict of interest.
He points to the fact that the faculty member who is handling complaints against the encampment was recently handpicked by the university's provost.
The administration have made statements against the encampment, against the students. They sent the police to disband it.
Then there's the message the decision sends to other students, especially low-income students of color like Acha. Hirschfeld says it's a betrayal of the university's commitment to free speech.
Because it feels particularly vindictive and particularly punitive, right, is going to send a really chilling message to students about the limits of what they're able to say, what they're able to advocate for, right? Because there's always that in the back of their minds.
Acha, for one, says she would do it all over again.
Our classmates, the people who would be in the same year as us in Gaza, are not going to graduate. Graduation is to celebrate, but it also, for me, has shown a lot about how the world needs to change.
Acha says that message will stick with her for life, especially as she figures out what she can do next without the degree she worked so hard for. Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
The University of Illinois will host a new National Center of Research on railroads. Emily Hayes has more.
U of I professor Chris Barkin studied how to safely store hazardous materials as they travel by rail, which railroads have since adopted. Universities between Kansas and Delaware will continue this kind of research as partners in the National University Rail Center of Excellence. Barkin will lead the center, and he says teaching students will be just as important.
Every engineering school has a highway engineering research program. Hardly any have a railway engineering research program, and yet more freight moves by rail than by highway.
Federal and state officials helped cut the ribbon on the new collaboration. Half of the $15 million startup costs will come from President Biden's 2021 infrastructure package. Other states and partner universities will take care of the rest. I'm Emily Hayes.
High school basketball players in Illinois will now learn to live with a shot clock. After a two-year experiment allowing it, the Illinois High School Association says it will adopt it for all boys and girls games starting with the 2026-27 school year. Association Executive Director Craig Anderson says the two-year lead time will allow schools to buy, install, and get used to the 35-second shot clocks. The association is also changing the schedule for state basketball finals. The three-day format remains, but the third place and semifinal times and days have moved around. The rare emergence of two broods of periodic cicadas at one time in central Illinois has attracted international attention from those who want to hear the pulsing, flowing, and sometimes ear-piercing mating choruses. Charlie Schlinker caught up with a composer of experimental music at Funk's Grove in McLean County.
Usually the thing that I'm looking for, you know, will disappear as soon as you talk. Whereas it's been really weird on this trip to be kind of not having to rush. Like, if they're there, they're there.
Karen Power is a composer from Ireland. She is in central Illinois because of the double brood emergence of cicadas. This year, for the first time in a couple centuries, 13 and 17-year cicadas emerged at the same time in central Illinois. Power likes incorporating natural sounds in her music. It has taken her to several continents, now to Springfield and further north to Funk's Grove in McLean County, to record what you're hearing now. Power got the idea of cicada music years ago in listening to a composition by electronic music pioneer Pauline Oliveros and the album Cicada Dream Band.
where they went out and played with the cicadas. And I remember just thinking, that's fantastic. And so I have been keeping an eye on the different cycles to see whether an interesting one might happen in my lifetime. And then I nearly missed this. It was only about 6 months ago I thought of it again and checked and realized, oh my God, it's 2024.
Power spends a lot of time listening to environments and then letting what she hears dictate how a piece might come about.
If the situation is where I'm working with improvisers and good listeners, that'll be a very different piece to if I'm working with like a symphony orchestra where it has to be notated, and then I bring the natural sound in with them, as opposed to my ideal situation is where humans and nature coincide. Over the years, I've kind of developed different systems of making this kind of thing work, because as you can imagine, musical systems are designed for a very particular purpose. You know, we have nice harmony, and then we have not so nice harmony. And we have all the rules about, you know, rhythmic relationships. And what got me into this in the first place was always feeling that I didn't quite belong within that structure. And so I would hear these things out in nature, but the moment you try to control them, they misbehave. And I really like that.
In recording the cicadas, Power says she's been surprised at the amount of movement and the layers of sound and the expanse of what she hears.
Think about what happens when you're standing over a river. And if you look straight down at the river, for all intents and purposes, that river is both stationary and in motion. Because the flow is never ending, it can feel almost static. Right, because there's no beginning, there's no end. And this is how I feel about the sounds that I'm hearing right now. It's just they are absolutely belonging to some vast system that we don't know anything about. And so they're endless, and there's so much motion in it.
In Funk's Grove, the cicadas are high in the trees. It's a little tougher to record them, though there are compensations.
Get something?
Yeah, some nice ticking, which usually gets drowned out. The frequency, the top end of the cicada call, links quite nicely with the wind. When does it become wind? When is it a cicada?
It's also evening, which Power has found is not a great time for the mating music.
It's definitely noticeable between 1:32 to 4:30. That's their given it all.
In Springfield, Power says she found a magical tree at Lincolnland Community College before heading off to Lincoln Memorial Gardens.
They were all over me. It was ridiculous. I had to double check everything before I put it back in the bag. And I thought I'd checked everything, and then I turned up at Lincoln Memorial and I pulled out the dish and there was one little guy like right in there. It's like, I'm sorry, I've displaced you.
Maybe he'll have better luck with the date.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you clearly weren't doing very well there, so.
Yeah, that's right.
But they really were. They were just everywhere.
Think of yourself as an Uber driver for this.
Yeah. I like that.
Power thinks the song of the 13-year brood of cicadas has a slightly different pitch than the 17-year variety.
It's the lower and the softer kind of constant shade you hear. It's not the call, it's not the, I'm not going to try to do it, but the actual, one of the mating calls is like a long line and then it dips. It's actually below that again, much softer.
And when she finds a good tree, she can put a mic in the tree and begin to pick up individual voices.
They're quite metallic, actually, and they're quite conversational. It's kind of quite broken, so you hear these kind of, and so when you start hearing a few of those around the place, then you get this little dialogue happening between them, and then of course you have the wing flapping sounds as well. Because they were on the ground as well, it made it possible to almost put the parabolic dish not over them, but like hover it over them, and you could pick up these tiny, tiny little motions, like just so that we've gotten everything from a fragment of a sentence to a word, to the full sentence, which is, yeah, I'm excited. I'm very excited by what I've been recording.
Karen Power says the periodic cicadas have so much to offer humans if they would take the time to know their extraordinary lives. It is a much different kind of life than the long, linear line we think of as life. Power says she hopes her eventual cicada music will offer audiences the perspective that not everything needs to conform with what humans believe it should be. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Some parts of Illinois are still in the noisy throes of the 17-year cicada emergence. In other areas, not a peep. So for those listeners suffering from cicada envy, Susan Stevens trekked out to a DeKalb County Forest Preserve to learn about the six-legged noisemakers from a nature educator and cicada superfan.
I'm Peggy Annesy with the University of Illinois Extension out here at Russell Woods Forest Preserve, 1 mile west of Genoa, Illinois. So you've got a cicada chorus and you've got cicadas. It's just somehow the magic of how it carries. And it's coming, it has to be like traveling and coming like a cloud of sound, whereas here you're getting zit, 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 all these individual males. And that's just the males. There's a boy. I'm kind of muffling it by holding it because it's, we looked it up. This timbal, wow. That apparatus right there.
Okay, that's what's making all the sound.
Both sides,
wow.
Yeah.
It's like
so,
drums.
Yeah, so when you pick them up, they don't bite, which is lovely because you can study them. Bad for them because people can harm them or animals just munch them up. And the males have a different abdominal part, obviously, without going into detail. The female has an ovipositor that slices, so when she lays eggs, she'll slice into a small twig of the plant or small branch, very small, and lay eggs in there. Those eggs will hatch and drop to the ground and be done. They're not gonna eat your tree anymore. And they do, to full-size trees, it does like no damage. You can really can't tell. Now to small trees, that they don't, these guys aren't eating that much. But if you get a lot of slices in small branches, you might have some death on the tips beyond the slice, is what I read.
Okay.
So they do eat a little bit. So if you had a tiny tree with very few leaves, they could eat a percentage that was pretty high.
Okay.
But they're not, like, taking out large trees.
Yeah. Who's eating these?
Everybody. Anybody that eats insects that's big enough to eat this insect. But there's a lot of scientific belief that this will not only fill bellies, because coyotes eat insects, all the way down to snakes and fish and whatever, frog, anything, my dog. My puppy ate five the other day and did nothing, didn't hurt him. It not only fills bellies, it's giving time for the other insects that usually get eaten to build up population. The sacrifice of all these cicadas actually adds up to a higher population of caterpillars and butterflies and all these other insects that we don't always find as attractive as the ones I just named, but that are potentially going to build up their own numbers again. I mean, think about it. At my age of going on 60, may or may not be here for the next one, so I got to pay as much attention as I can. I think at some point we're going to hear like, oh wait, I didn't notice, but there's less, because you get used to it. I'm totally used to it. I work out here and it's like just how it is. But at some point I'll probably look at myself in about 2 or 3 weeks and go, wait a minute. I hear them, but it isn't that many. The sound is down. Maybe all the females stay longer to make sure all the eggs get deposited. You have to ask the cicada. It's got to be prime right now, so don't miss the opportunity to get out. But they're the loudest when they're the warmest. Yeah. Unlike our annuals come out in the evening a little more, or later, mid-afternoon to later afternoon. These guys, when it gets warm, they're squawking. So if you have a lunch break, you know, you can get out here as soon as possible from work, but your best time would be midday if you can run out and get it done.
That was Peggy Annesy at Russell Woods Forest Preserve in Genoa. There's more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. We're back on Statewide. When Julio Rodriguez was 15, he became separated from his family. He slept for a year and a half in the back of an ice cream shop where he worked. Today, Rodriguez is 64 and board president of the Chicago Housing Organization for Youth, La Casa Norte, and is founder and president of the Association of Latinos Motivating for Action, one of the oldest organizations in the country for the queer Latinate community. He's also deputy director of workforce programs for the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity. And he recently spoke with reporter Maureen McKinney about his struggles as a gay homeless youth.
Grew up in Lakeview. Before it was Boys Town, when it was a predominantly Puerto Rican community. My background is my family is from Puerto Rico. I'm a first generation because I was born here in Chicago. And both my parents came here from Puerto Rico. So my dad always makes a joke that Lakeview went from being all Puerto Rican to gay just like I did. And I always have to remind him, no, Dad, I'm still Puerto Rican and I'm gay.
Tell me about your experiences with homelessness.
My mother started to experience a lot of mental health issues and had some very serious episodes that could be violent that required us to actually have to move several times. I actually attended 5 elementary schools in Lakeview as a result of my mom's mental illness. Because of the type of mental health issues she had, she just experienced a lot of delusions. And some of those delusions centered around my father. And so my father had to leave us by the time I entered being a freshman in high school. But as a result of my mom's mental health issues, I had started working at a very young age at 14. And part of that was just not to be in the home and to have to keep experiencing a lot of her episodes. But one evening in the summer of 76, her illness had culminated into a very explosive event. I was not there at the time. It was my younger sister and her. I was working that evening, and when I got home, our apartment door was wide open and the neighbor had come to me and said that my mother and my sister had to flee because my mother had attacked the landlord. And as a result of that, they had to flee because they were at risk of being assaulted by several people in the building. Now, mind you, this was 1976, so there were no cell phones. We actually did not have a phone in our home. And so the only avenues for us to communicate with the outside world was really to use payphones. But that night, because I had gotten home around midnight, there was nobody at home. My neighbors had told me that the best thing I should do was to leave because I could be at risk of being assaulted because of my mom's actions. And so the next thing I know, I was on Kedzie and Lawrence at around 1 a.m. trying to figure out what I was going to do at the age of, at that time, I would have been about 15 and a half. And so I worked at a Baskin and Robbins, and I knew there was a cot in the back. And I fortunately, because I had become one of the managers of the store and I had the keys. So for the next 6 months, I slept at the Baskin and Robbins a few blocks away from my high school. And for about a year and a half, I basically was homeless. I was fortunate by the time my senior year had come, I had figured out to get an apartment and I then supported myself on my own. I had no idea where my family was or how I would get back in touch with them. And as you know, the 70s was, I don't think people realize, you know, places like Lakeview, Edgewater, you know, Albany Park were very violent areas. In fact, I remember one evening being on Belmont and Broadway, and a number of trans women came up to me and they said, you know, you can't stay out here. And I was like, well, no, I'm just kind of hanging out. And they go, nope, it's late. And everybody knows that you're out here. The minute you came off that bus and you didn't have an adult with you, everybody who's anybody and doing business on this street is paying attention to you. You know, now when I look back at it as an adult, it was probably some of the best advice I got. I don't know what would have happened, because at that point in time, many young people were being abducted and put into the life of prostitution. In fact, I remember walking around and just seeing a lot of cars just following me. And so I just learned that it was better to just go to school and go back to the ice cream store and just stay there, because being outside at night was the risk were just so high. And then I also got a little bit of schooling from some of the other older teenagers who said, you know, the other people you have to watch out for are the police. And I, you know, being naive, I said, well, why is that? And I go, because if they pick you up, they're not going to ask you. They're going to call child welfare. And the next thing you know, you're going to be in a foster home. And, you know, what little I knew about the foster care system, I knew that that would be the last place that I would want to be. And so I spent a great deal of my time in those years, avoiding the police, avoiding, you know, certain areas of the North Side, and then creating this whole story that I was living at home with my two parents and everything was great. To just kind of connect this to being gay, you know, I knew I was gay probably from as early on as 5, but I did not see being gay as something negative. I actually found being gay gave me a certain self-awareness and perception of people, because I think being gay makes you very much an observer of people and an observer of your environment. And so I learned very, very quickly how to not only adapt to heterosexual culture, learned how to use my gayness, if you will, to sort of afford myself certain ways to interact with people. Like, I found very few people would ask me questions because they suspected I might be gay. So they really didn't want to know much about me. So it was very, very easy for me to create this secondary persona. In fact, many of my friends from high school that I still am in touch with had no idea that I was living alone and that I was taking care of myself my junior and senior year.
You must have been extremely resourceful.
And, you know, I'm a product of television. You know, one of the things that was very interesting, because neither one of my parents had much of a formal education in Puerto Rico. And obviously, when they came here, they pretty much went to work very quickly and never obtained any real formal education. So I learned most of my language skills watching television. And in particular, sitcoms. When I went to enroll in elementary school, I went with my mom, and my mom could barely speak English. And I sat there talking with the counselor and filling out the forms with her. And I remember the counselor turning to me and saying, how old are you? And I said, 5. And she, you actually know what those questions are asking you? And I go, oh yeah. I go, I watch so-and-so, and I watched when they went to school, and I know the kinds of questions that you'll ask. So I actually skipped kindergarten and went right into first grade. And even though I didn't learn English in my household and I learned it through television, I not only learned the language, I learned situational language. So I actually learned how to cope with certain things in life, you know, dramas. I remember watching police shows, and that actually was what made me more astute when it came to the streets and to police. And so I really credit the fact that my exposure to many sort of shows that kind of emulated life as a way for me to sort of acquire a body of knowledge that helped me be resourceful during that time that I was experiencing homelessness.
What were some of the shows?
So things like Dragnet. This is going to sound silly, but shows like Bewitched, where there was an Uncle Arthur, and I knew that that character was gay, and just knowing that, you know, gay makes you sort of this unique individual that is always sort of smarter than everyone in the room and wittier, that being gay didn't have to be out with it, but you could actually morph into this individual by which people sort of admired and wanted around, even though they didn't want to really know anything about them. And then in terms of my street smarts, I remember in particular watching a program. She played a young girl who had run away from home and was in the streets of New York and was being forced to go into prostitution. And I remember how much as I was walking around some of the evenings, how much that movie taught me about the dangers of urban life that otherwise I would never have been exposed to until I was actually there. But it's really those kinds of shows and movies that sort of indirectly made me aware of the risk and also taught me that say less, make sure that you assess a situation very carefully and never presume that somebody who says they want to help you don't have other intentions, especially when you're young and people sense that you're alone or that they're not immediate adults in your life.
You had to have been very bright.
I've had this conversation with many of my queer friends about how some of us, it kind of gave us a sixth sense. This being gay created us a heightened awareness of people and how people interact. And, you know, there is, I think, a truism that when you're an outsider, you become an observer of life. And that really creates a certain skill set that is not easily taught, but when you acquire it, it can be a door to many opportunities. I think where I am in my life is as a result of because I was gay and because I had that sort of sixth sense and that, you know, ability to adapt in any environment that I was put in.
Do you think some of your resourcefulness had to do with having been raised by someone who was mentally ill?
I do. It took many years for me to reconcile that. In the 70s, mental illness, particularly in the Latino community, was addressed in very, very damaging ways, you know, through religion. I went to a seance with my mother in which people were trying to, you know, do an exorcism because they were convinced the thing that was wrong with her was that she had the devil. And, you know, and really all that did was just traumatize her even further and made her episodes even more intense because now they had a religious connotation to them. And so it just made her delusions even more heightened. I was very fortunate, and I can't stress this enough. I never doubted my mom's love for me. I think the hardest thing for those of us who are experiencing it is it's reminding you yourself that it's a disease and that it's taken hold of them, but that doesn't make them void of love for you. I remember some of my mom's worst episodes, and she would come into my room and she would sit at the foot of my bed, rubbing my legs and saying, you know, whatever happens, I always love you. Her life was fraught with a lot of just trauma. As I learned that as an adult, it really helped me frame a lot of things that happened in my childhood with some of the guilt, some of the anger, some of the helplessness that I had felt for so long.
That's Julio Rodriguez explaining his story about what it was like to grow up as a gay, homeless youth. We're out of time for Statewide this week. Thanks for being along, and join us next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Find our shows where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.